Hey, Michael Steele podcast listeners, Michael Steele here with another quick take from the Michael Steele podcast. Check out what's going on right now.
Welcome back, everybody, to Michael Steele podcast. We are having a great conversation with Professor Carol Anderson, the Charles Howard Candler Professor of African American Studies at Emory University, and the author of three important books. And we're talking about each of them, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Nation's Divide. One Person, One Vote, No Vote. One Person, No Vote. How Voter Suppression is Destroying Our Democracy. And now we're going to turn our attention to her latest book called The Second, Race and Guns in a Fatally Unequal America. It's a little bit of a sidebar, but I think it kind of goes to the core of what you're talking about in The Second, about the connection between race and guns in this country. How did we get to the point that this became something that was so essential to the South, but not essential to the North? This sort of dividing line between free states and slave states, North and South. I get it, 1619, the whole process and how that sort of evolves. But when you get to the late 1700s, and the sort of formation of government and the founding of this republic, is it because slavery had become such an economic engine for the South to the point that the humanity of the individuals didn't matter anymore? Or I'm just, so people can kind of understand how something so horrid was able to really not just stain, but indelibly stain the United States.
And so you had this fusion of tapping into religion to justify the unjustifiable, to make slavery appear to be God ordained, because these were heathens, because these were savages, because of the curse of Ham, that this is their place, this is their natural status. Once you have it God ordained, and then you have the economics rolling out of this, by the time we got to the Civil War, slavery accounted for about 80% of the nation's GNP. I mean, it was just a massive economic engine. And for the North also gained lots of resources off of slavery, from the banking that the slavery required.
Yeah, okay.
To the shipping that slavery required. The North also got a lot of resources off of this. But part of what happened, and this is the piece that I wrote in The Guardian about the danger of white supremacy, is not just its existence, but that it is never held accountable for the damage that it does to American society, to American democracy. And white supremacy cannot be sated. You can't appease it. It always wants more. And this is what was happening with the South. So the South gets this fugitive slave clause, the Atlantic slave trade, the three-fifths clause, and the Second Amendment. And they're like, cool. So as you expand North, as you expand West, we want slavery to expand West. And the North is like,
no, that's not happening.
And you get this where, you know, Joanne Freeman has this wonderful book, Field of Blood, where she talks about the ways that Southern congressmen would physically beat on Northern congressmen and Northern senators over the issues of slavery to stop slavery from even being discussed in Congress. When we get to the 1850 Fugitive Slave Law, Slave Act, the North was like, okay, we're done. We are done appeasing you. We are finished appeasing you. There's not enough appeasement that will satisfy you. You want it all.
Mm-hmm.
And this becomes the kind of break that we see where the North was like, okay.
That eventually led to the Civil War.
Yes.
So you note in the second measures to expand and curtail gun ownership aimed disproportionately at the African-American population. The right to bear arms has been consistently used as a weapon to keep African-Americans powerless, revealing that armed and or unarmed Blackness, it would seem, is the threat that must be neutralized and punished. Is that still the order of the day in your view?
Yes. I mean, it is. Think about how many times you have heard about somebody Black being gunned down who was unarmed. Mm-hmm. But the word is, we feared. He was a threat. He was dangerous. So I think about, for instance, Jonathan Farrell, who was a Black man in North Carolina who got into a car accident. He got out of his car. He knocked on the door. A woman was afraid. You know, she sees a Black guy there, so she calls the cops. When the cops show up, he thinks, oh, great, the cops are here to help me because I've been in an accident. As he's walking towards them, they start shooting. And the language is, we were afraid. Think about Tamir Rice, who is the 12-year-old boy in Cleveland who was playing alone. And Ohio is an open carry state, playing alone in a park with a toy gun. And granted, the orange tip wasn't on this toy gun that said, hey, I'm a toy. Mm-hmm. But Ohio is an open carry state. And it says, the law says, as long as you're not pointing the gun at anybody, as long as you're not threatening anybody, you can open carry. So he's in a park by himself playing. The cops roll up and within 2 seconds, they shoot him. And they say, we were afraid. He was a threat. He was dangerous. Now, juxtapose that to Kyle Rittenhouse.
Mm. See, now you're about to make me mad. Okay, go ahead. I'm listening. Right.
So I'm listening. You get this 17-year-old white guy who comes in to cross the state lines and has an illegally obtained AR-15. He walks by the cops and the cops welcome him. Welcome him. Hey, we're so glad you guys are here. It's hot out here. You want some water? Rittenhouse then goes and he guns down 3 people, killing 2 of them. He walks back towards the cops with his hands up. The cops go right by him. They don't see threat. They don't see danger. They don't see fear. And instead, what we get is this rallying around Kyle Rittenhouse as this well-regulated militia.
See. Yeah.
Yeah.
You've left me a little bit speechless on that one because it just wells up an enormous amount of anger for me when I look at and listen to that narrative, because you and I know damn well that if Kyle Rittenhouse were any young Black man in America walking down the middle of the street with an AR-15, that brother wouldn't get to take a second step.
Okay.
And we're not just saying that, folks. Y'all know it to be true. Carol's already given us 3 examples. You know, Tamir Rice playing by himself, right? Nobody around. He's in a park by himself with a toy gun. Well, who was the young kid who was in the Walmart?
John Crawford.
John Crawford.
Who was 23, and in a Walmart that sells guns.
Right.
In an open carry state.
Right.
And he's carrying a BB gun.
Right.
And he is gunned down by the cops because they thought they were in an active shooter situation.
Right. And here you are in the midst of rioting. The police are scouring around on high alert. And this young white boy walking down the street, having just shot 3 people, killing 2 of them. Yeah. And they just like, everything okay? You doing well? Hey, can you want some water? You need a ride home? They took him back home.
Right? I mean, this is This is,
oh my God.
Okay. So, and so this is why I'm like, it's not about the guns. It's about the anti-blackness. It's the anti-blackness that were in the initial slave codes that said black people cannot have arms because they are a threat to the white community. It is the same thing that leads to the Second Amendment, where George Mason is talking about, if we don't have the militia, we will be left defenseless. And then I think about how Lauren Boebert talks about how if we don't have our guns, we will be left defenseless against the gangbangers, the thugs, and the drug dealers.
And they are, in fact, the biggest threat to America.
Ooh.
It's not, it's not Tamir Rice. It's Kyle Rittenhouse.
Yes. Yes.
So let's connect some final dots here.
Yes.
How do we, so I'm at the end of the day, and I say this, my oldest son and I get into really deep, heated arguments about stuff. And I always say to him, I appreciate the anger, but what's your solution?
Mm-hmm.
So starting with white rage, how do we begin to piece together a solution to that unspoken truth of this nation?
And thank you for that. because I firmly, firmly believe that the vast majority of folks don't know how we got here and they want to know. And so the way that we begin to break the power of white rage is through engagement and education, by laying the facts out there. We've got that hardcore rump of folks who live in an alternative fact world,
right?
Who live in a fact-free world. There's nothing you can do with them. But the vast majority of Americans want to know. And so it is through these kinds of podcasts, it's through the writings, it's through the speeches, it's through the engagement on social media about how we got here. This is how we begin to change. That's how you begin to break the power of white rage. When you begin to hold the elected officials accountable for enacting white rage policies, where they see that there is no gold in them their hills, this is how we begin to make a difference.
How do we begin to turn that corner and put in place the right solutions when it comes to our voting rights and responsibilities, dealing with, as you walk us through in the book, One Person, No Vote, with voter suppression and those elements of suppression, which at the end are all meant to undermine the true essence of this democracy.
And so I started writing that book for two reasons. One, when I was out giving talks on white rage, and I have a chapter in there, how to unelect a black president.
Right.
And I've got a piece in there about voter suppression, the voter ID laws. And inevitably I would get a question. Well, I don't understand. Why is voter ID so bad? And I thought, whoa, there has been a really good job in selling this thing, in cloaking what it is really designed to do. It was that, as well as after the 2016 election, pundits were going, well, you know, black folks just didn't show up because, you know, they couldn't stand Hillary because, you know, black folks hate Hillary. They just couldn't stand Hillary. So they just didn't show up.
Right.
And I went, you know, this was the first presidential election in 50 years without the protection of the Voting Rights Act. Maybe that might have something to do with the 7% drop in black voter turnout, duh. And so I went through to systematically show how voter suppression works, to look behind the curtain of the Wizard of Oz, to see the little man pulling the levers. Because once we understand how those levers are pulled, why those levers are pulled, then we're having a very different kind of conversation. So you have grassroots organizations that are doing enormous, important work in getting folks registered to vote, in getting folks the IDs that they need to be able to vote, in challenging these laws that are about how do we keep Black folk and Brown folk and Native American folk, young folk from voting, poor folk from voting. How do we do that? And so it is, again, by laying it out there, what really is this thing? What really is poll closures? What really is voter roll purges? Because you're like, well, you don't want dead people on the rolls. Yes, of course you don't want dead people on the rolls, but where they're knocking off the most folks are the folks who haven't voted regularly. And those are overwhelmingly.
I can tell you for a fact that the whole dead voter premise for purging voter rolls is a smokescreen for what's really beneath there. That then gives them access to going in and purging out voters who oftentimes are still legitimately registered.
But
because they haven't voted in one or two cycles, it's like, oh, I'm sorry, you don't vote anymore. You stopped voting. So we just, it is very much the case, folks. I can tell you firsthand that's how that plays out oftentimes.
Hey, everybody. Thanks so much for listening today. Please go to Apple Podcasts and give us a 5-star review. Heck, give us 2 5-star reviews. I love it. Or catch us on Stitcher, iHeart, TuneIn, or wherever you get that podcast thing on. You know how that goes. Peace out.
Retaliation with Julie Roginski is a weekly podcast focused on the stories of women who have spoken truth to power and have persevered despite the costs. It shares the experiences of courageous people who have sometimes been celebrated, but too often castigated for standing up for themselves and for others. Each week, I examine the structures, systems, and culprits responsible for perpetuating and promoting workplace toxicity. You'll hear stories from female celebrities, music label executives, politicians, police officers, and many others as we examine the cultural reevaluations, policy changes, and legal steps that can finally bring an end to the ongoing attack on women in this country and around the world. Listen on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.